Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Alice McKeon, your chair for today. I would like to welcome the Bay Gourmet member-led forum along with the International Relations member-led forum, the co-sponsors of this evening's program. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. For 17 years, Dana Whitaker taught English and social sciences to inner city and alternative high school students and trained and coached teachers. Then in 2002, she learned about the power of microfinance. When she saw how it transforms people's lives through self-employment, improved nutrition, health, schooling, and housing, family stability, dignity, self-esteem, and hope for a future, she took a leave of absence from her teaching career in order to travel around the world. She recorded the stories of women who had become micro-entrepreneurs and how they proved that microfinance is the most effective way to alleviate world poverty. In the process, she became an international photojournalism entrepreneur herself. Please welcome Dana Whitaker.
Thank you all for coming, and this is working. Thank you so much for setting me up. So I want to begin and tell you why I wrote this book. It's because of you. When I learned about the power of microfinance in a very casual conversation with my stepfather in 2002, who said, Dana, you've traveled all over the world, you've been to developing countries, what do you think about microfinance? And I hesitated and I said, micro what? I'd never heard of it. But when he told me about the success that microfinance has had that I'm going to share with you later in helping eradicate poverty in the world, I wanted everybody, including all of you, to know about it. Because maybe you, like I, would get inspired to share your expertise, to share your time and your energy and other resources in helping partner with people who may not have the resources, the financial resources we have, but they have the resourcefulness to move forward if they can only get that kind of help. So that planted a seed, that little, that conversation with my stepfather planted the seed that later became this book, Transforming Lives, $40 at a Time, Women Plus Microfinance, Upending the Status Quo. And this was a 3.5-year journey that I took, as Alice mentioned, which began like this. I was a teacher in the inner city, and something started gurgling inside of me, saying I wanted to do something else with my life, but I wasn't sure what it was. And on a trip, I went on a trip to Cuba and to learn about Castro-style communism. And then I really started going wild. What is it that I want to do besides teach in the inner city, which gave me so much? It gave me so much, but I wanted to do something else, and I wasn't sure what it was. So I met with a professor who'd been on the trip with me, and I said, Francisco, could I meet with you, and you can help me figure out what I'm going to be doing next with my life? So 2.5 hours into a lunch where we were going absolutely nowhere, he asked me a key question. He said, Dana, if you could do anything in the world, what would you do? And I said, I would travel around the world, and I would photograph and interview people in different cultures, and then in that moment, I remembered my conversation with my stepfather, and I said, and those people are going to be micro-entrepreneurs, and I'm going to write a book about it. And I was just beside myself for exactly 1 week. And then what set in was what Joseph Campbell talks, the belly of the whale. When we get a call to do something and we really move and we say, this is what I want to do, the belly of the whale is that, who the heck do you think you are that you could be a professional photographer, that you could interview and write about people and get to the essence of their lives with the dignity that they deserve? So I was really in the belly of the whale. I was at the bottom of the deepest ocean for about 8 months. And periodically, I would come up and I would say to my husband, Mark, oh, this is really a good idea. But somehow I couldn't get myself started to doing it. And then one day, 8 months later, he said to me when I yet came to take a breath of air to tell him that again, he said, you know, you are so clearly passionate about this. I think if you don't do it, you will be sorry someday. And that's what I needed. What an ally, which we all need in our lives. And the next morning, I made my first phone call of many to a microfinance organization. And I said, I'm writing a book, and I would love to feature some of your clients in it. What do you think? And they said, we would love it. And I was beside myself. They didn't ask if I was a professional photographer, how many books I'd written. It didn't matter at all. They said, we would love to have you. And so they said that they were taking a trip with people who were interested or already involved in microfinance to Ghana. And I said, I will be going on that trip. So I called my husband. I said, well, I'm going to Ghana in about a month and a half, and I've just got to get my, you know, the shots and that sort of thing. And one of the first people I met in my 3.5-year journey is pictured on the cover of my book. And this is Stella Sabang. And Stella has just received in her hands a $340 loan. Now, she started with $40. And that's why I named the book Transforming Lives, $40 at a Time. She has paid back her loan on time, in full, plus interest. And every time she's done that, she, like millions of women around the world, have an opportunity to get a larger loan to build their businesses bigger and bigger. So Stella used to be a trader of maize, and she was so poor, she literally would sell cupfuls of maize, dried corn, to people and use what she made to buy what kind of food she could for her family. Excuse me. She's no longer that person carrying that cup of maize around. In fact, she's not only just a retailer. She's also a wholesaler now. She buys bigger and bigger bags and more bags of maize that she sells to other women who may not be ready to be entrepreneurs themselves, but she sells them bags, plus with interest. They don't pay her up front. So she makes a profit that way. And now she is able to take care of her family and feed them and house them and clothe them, including the little baby who's on her back. Can see the little feet sticking out. So before I begin, what I'd like you to do is see what it's like to get in that mood, that mindset of being someone who needs microfinance. So I invite you just to sit back and close your eyes and imagine. Imagine your house. Take a mental walk through each room, admiring all you have accumulated. The soft fabric covering a cozy sofa, a beautiful piece of art adorning a well-painted sturdy wall, a memory-provoking curio ornamenting a book-filled shelf. Open closets overflowing with linens, hanger upon hanger of warm jackets and coats, stacks of games, extra toys, and boxes bursting with holiday decorations. Now return to each room and unplug everything electric. Heated blankets, alarm clocks, your hair dryer, the stove, oven, refrigerator, microwave, dishwasher, washer, and dryer. All lamps, telephones, televisions, and computers. Now imagine emptying your house of all these items. Roll up every rug, pull up all the carpeting, and remove every window pane throughout your house. Now imagine ridding your home of these things too. Disable the heater, air conditioner, and plumbing, and turn off the water main into your house. Then move one bed, a few blankets, one dresser, one small table, and a single chair, a few bowls, pots, and utensils, and a bag of beans and rice into one small room of your house. Allow each family member to choose one pair of shoes, one change of clothes, and one special keepsake, a book, a photograph, a piece of jewelry, or a toy. Put these things in that small room as well. Now, imagine your manicured lawn and gardens, the rest of your house, and all its contents disappearing. Literally, billions of people around the world do not need to imagine this scenario because they live it every day or worse. I want to share with you some statistics. Around the globe, there are 3 billion people who are struggling to survive on $2 or less each day. Of those, 2.7 billion are of working age, but they have no access to financial assistance. Of that 3 billion, 1.2 billion are struggling to survive on $1 or less a day. 23,000 children die every single day from preventable diseases, pneumonia, malaria, malnutrition, diarrhea. There are 1 billion people on our planet who are unable to read a book, unable to sign their names, and not surprisingly, 2/3 of those are female. Every 60 seconds, a woman dies during or just after childbirth. The result is annually 1 million children left motherless. Around the world, it is estimated that there are 1 million trafficking victims every year. In every single big city you can imagine, unfortunately, including San Francisco, trafficking victims are here. These are big problems in the world. What can we do? It's like, where do we begin to make a difference in the world? We can be so overwhelmed by these statistics, especially when you see them face to face. What do we do? Well, microfinance is a key. Notice that I didn't say it is the key, and I'll get to that in a moment. It is a key to poverty alleviation. But what I really like to call wealth creation, and wealth creation is not just about money. It's about changes internally as well. To all of a sudden have pride for being who you are, for having your own business, for going to school, for being able to take care of your children, etc. That this wealth creation is so much bigger than finances, but finances are a key to it. So microfinance, what I really, really like about it and believe so strongly in it, as do people who are involved in microfinance, is that microfinance is all about a partnership. There's resourcefulness of people who just lack the financial need to move forward. And there are resources that all of us, even in this room, have to share. As I mentioned earlier, from expertise to dollars, to time, to energy. So why do we need microfinance? What's the matter with traditional banking? Well, traditional banking really requires people to be able to go in and read documents and sign their name. Professor Muhammad Yunus, who started the Grameen Bank, who won the Nobel Peace Prize along with Grameen Bank in 2006, says microfinance turns finance 180 degrees in the right direction. Many microfinance organizations that help fund women and men to become micro-borrowers and micro-entrepreneurs of their having their own businesses don't require women or men to be literate. Their thumbprint can stand as a declaration that they are going to use their loans to start businesses and to build them. I don't know about you, but I don't know of a bank where you could take out a loan and not have collateral backing you. This woman in this picture is Pentima. She is a Dalit. A Dalit is another word for untouchable in India. The word untouchable, the term untouchable is not used. However, Dalits still exist. And they are the lowest of the low, so low that they're not even constituted part of the caste system. They're below the caste system. They're relegated to the far reaches of villages. We walked and walked and walked through this village and finally came to a group of Dalits, including Pentima. This is her bedroom. That is her bed. It serves four people, her husband and her two children. All their worldly belongings are in those bags. The roof of their house is on the, as you can see also. Rain is not going to stop when it reaches that roof. It's going to go through. A bank is not going to take that house as collateral for a loan. Furthermore, most traditional banks are not in villages. They're not in remote areas. Microfinance brings banking to the people rather than making the people go to the bank. Nor do people need collateral. And you'll learn why later, what kind of collateral is being used instead of someone's house and belongings. Microfinance is necessary because it is, it's been reported by Grameen Foundation, which is an organization in the United States that does microfinance lending, and they do the due diligence rather than having an individual do the due diligence on every microfinance organization. You go straight to Grameen Foundation, and they've done that if you so choose to contribute financially in a way. But they also do a lot of research. On average, money lenders charge between 125% and 300% interest. Who could ever pull themselves out of poverty with that sort of interest? They couldn't. In the same way, banks have been reticent to service micro borrowers because the cost is prohibitive. They've seen the cost is prohibitive to even hire someone to input a 10-cent deposit, right? It costs more than that. So they've been reticent to do that, and that is changing, thankfully. So we now know why we need microfinance, because traditional banking is not serving the needs of the poor. But what exactly is microfinance? And I'm so excited to say that it's growing and it's getting bigger since it began, which was so interesting to me when I did the research on it, that it began in the 1970s. Opportunity International is one of the organizations that started in Colombia in 1971. Acción, what has become Acción International, started it in 1973. On the other side of the globe, there's Muhammad Yunus in Bangladesh starting microfinance there. And you can see, as of December 2010, U.S. dollars, $5.52 billion has been given out loaned to microborrowers. So what is microfinance? It has two components. There's a financial and a non-financial component. The financial component is this. There are microcredit. When you hear that, that just means loans. Microfinance is the overarching term. Loans with interest. Microfinance is not a handout. It is a loan. It changes the status when it's a loan versus, here, let me give you this. it's down like that versus the partnership. Here this is, we're loaning you this money, you pay it back with interest. That changes someone's internal view of themselves when they know that they are being respected enough to, here's the loan and we expect you to pay back. It becomes a partnership. Savings are really important too. A piece of research that I read recently is that for every one person that gets a micro loan, there are seven people who want a safe savings vehicle. Here's an example of why. Think of the tsunami. Think of the Haitian earthquake. Think of what all the different disasters in the world. If you don't have a safe place to put your money, where is it? It's dug deep in the ground underneath your mat. It might be up in a rafter. The disaster hits, and where does everything that you have ever earned go? It goes away. It disappears. You have nothing to say, this is how much money I have. This is what my worth is. So you lose everything. And so it's really, really important to have safe savings vehicles, banks, where people can put their money and it won't be tampered with until they're ready to use it for whatever purposes they want to use it. Remittance services are this. If someone cannot find work in their own country, they may go to a different country and they'll work there and they'll want to send money back to their family. Well, there's an organization in Haiti called Fonkoze, and Anne Hastings is the president of that, and she came up with the first, and now been duplicated, affordable, safe, secure way to send money from one country to another. And when I say it's duplicated, different microfinance organizations get together around the world and they meet and they discuss best practices. So that's why I say that it's now different microfinance organizations too who are allowing, providing this for their clients. Insurance, why would someone who's poor need insurance any less than somebody who's rich? So important to have housing insurance and business insurance and life insurance. In Ghana, what one does when someone in a family dies is that they invite the entire community to a party. And what the microfinance organizations were finding was that people were using all their savings and sometimes the loans they were getting to supply food and entertainment for this celebration of someone's life. So they said, we need to start a life insurance opportunity for people who are poor. The most recent one that I've read about is climate insurance. With the droughts around the world, in Africa in particular, if people are taking out a loan and they're buying seeds and they're planting and there's no rain, they are going to be out the loan and out any income, right? They're not able to pay back something that didn't grow. So they're able to buy what's called climate insurance. So that's changed people's lives so they're not losing all their savings and getting further and further into debt. Jaida is one of the women who I met in India. She's in the picture there, Mrs. Jayama. And she is busy weaving at mock speed a series of these coils, and when she has 15 of these coils she attaches them together, and they serve as a bed, a chair. And when someone is married, they get one of these as a gift, and it serves as the place where they're married during the ceremony, and then their first wedding bed. So she is married to Mr. Romulo, and he was making between $1.55 and $1.75 a day when there was work. She would be making less than he would. They were not living on that, as you can imagine. So when Share Microfin came to them and said to a group of women, this is very typical, an organization goes into a community and they say, they have a presentation and they say, we are offering loans to anyone who would like to consider starting their own businesses or building their own business. She already had this business, but it was not growing. And so as terrified as these women are, And every single woman I met said that. It was so scary. These women are steeped in poverty. They're making between $2 and $1 a day when there is work. If I take out a loan, will my business grow? Will I be able to pay that loan back with interest and potentially savings? If I don't, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to my family? We'll be even more in poverty. But the options, these women, like Mrs. Jayama said, I've got to take a chance. So she took a chance. She took out a $111 loan. She was able to buy more of these reeds in bulk, and that's the trick, right? Whenever we buy things in bulk, right? We know Costco, right? Same sort of thing. Things, when you buy in bulk, the price goes down. She was able to buy a bunch of reeds, weave many mats, and another common denominator of microfinance is that oftentimes the spouse joins the job. And so Mr. Romulo would take half the mats, she would take the other after she'd woven 11 or 12, and they would go and they would each go and sell the mats elsewhere and then come back at the end of the day with profits. Here's Mr. Romulo, here are their two children, and what you see in the background is quite a miraculous change in their lives. They share a house through that green door with another family that's separated only by a half wall. But what Mr. Romulo did with the first profits from the first loan that his wife took out was he built the family's first bathroom and shower that you can see in the picture on the left. And he said to me, and every single bit of profit that we get, I'm going to build a brand new house for my family. And Mrs. Jayama said, and we're going to send our two children to school, something neither of us have ever been to. So this is changing the lives of, you know, it's more than just money. It changes the life. Just think of the sanitation and that the children are not going to be getting sick like they could if they didn't have a bathroom and a place to take a shower. Many people think that microfinance is purely international. Let me tell you, thank goodness that it's not. If you look at the poverty rate in the United States today, it's 9.4%. And in the Bay Area alone, it's 12.5%. What does that mean? That means that someone has to decide every single month, am I going to pay the heating bill? Am I going to stop having a cell phone? Am I not going to be able to buy three meals a day for my children? Every single month. That's what that means if you're in poverty. So microfinance has the name microenterprise in the United States. It's the only country in the world that uses that term, microenterprise. So can't tell you why, but that's the truth. So it's in every state in the United States. The Bay Area and there are people here who are working as volunteers for the next 10 weeks. As fellows at Women's Initiative for Self-Employment. Would you raise your hands if you're here doing that? Yeah. So I recommend if any of you are interested in learning about domestic microfinance, I'm on the board of Women's Initiative, and that's primarily a business training organization for women who want to start businesses of their own. And the microloan component is secondary, but still important. In the picture, Judith Pothier became a friend of mine. She lives in Oregon. And I don't want to tell you her whole story. I don't want to ruin the story for you. But Judith, you see her service dog, Higgins, in the foreground there. When she was a young teen, she was in a DUI accident. Her mother was the driver. And the doctor said that she wouldn't live, and she lived. And the doctor said she would never stand again, and she stood. And what she is working on right there with a seamstress is her creation. And it is a wraparound blanket that she called the ultimate blanket that she created in a moment of frustration in her wheelchair when yet again her blanket got wrapped up in the wheels of her wheelchair, and she said, I have got to figure out a way to do this, to fix this problem. So out of that frustration was born a business. And one of the organizations that I really love to talk about is called the Abilities Fund. And the Abilities Fund not only provides loans for women and men who are handicapped in some way, but also teaches different organizations throughout the United States that people who may have handicaps of some sort are no less qualified to become micro-borrowers. So they have that policy piece, too. Well, I do want to tell you a little story, because this is not in this in the story, but Judith emailed me one day, and she said, "So I really want you to be thinking of me tomorrow, because I'm going to try to get my driver's license." And I said, "Let me know." So the next day, I got an email. "Dear Dana, I'm just now wondering what kind of car I'm going to buy." So, yeah, it is an O, isn't it? Okay, those are the financial components. The non-financial components are just as important in microfinance. And I'll just start with a picture. Woman in a blue wig. Any of you know her? This is Bake Sale Betty. Bake Sale Betty is actually a graduate of Women's Initiative for Self-Employment. What that means is that she got business training for 10 weeks where she could only graduate if she had a business plan. And she learned accounting, and she learned marketing, and she's learned how to network. And not only does she have her own business, she has two sites now in the East Bay, and she has hired 80 employees. So, and she gives back tremendously to the community. In fact, I just need to put a plug in for Women's Initiative. On average, women who have graduated with a business plan from Women's Initiative give $1,000 back to the community, including to Women's Initiative, because of all that they have gained from going through the business training program. So Bake Sale Betty is no exception. But you can imagine how different it is for Stella Sabang on the cover of my book to start a business than it is in a developed country where all the regulations are, there are so many regulations and licenses and fees and those sorts of things. So this is really essential in developing countries such as the United States and France, where I met another couple women who were featured in the book as well. What it takes to start a business and maintain it. How many of you are entrepreneurs here in the room? Right. So, right, you know it. Like every 5 years, you redo your license and you find, you know, your name and all that sort of thing. All those things aren't as important in the developing world at this point, but they certainly are in the developed world. Microfinance is also about health. Now, why? Because if children or the micro-borrowers themselves are sick, they can't work. They've taken out a loan, they're supposed to be building their business, but they can't because they've got to take care of their children or themselves. You learned earlier that 1 billion people on the planet can't read, and two-thirds of those are women. So Crecer is an organization. It has some of the work that it does is in Bolivia, which is where I am here. And you can see that on these laminated sheets where they are learning about the importance of washing fruits and vegetables before eating them so that your children won't get sick or so that you won't get sick. Part of it is pictorial and part of it is in writing. So there's a little bit of literacy training going on as well here. But then no one in the group of micro-borrowers is going to not understand, because you've got both options about how to learn about the importance of washing fruits and vegetables is. Now, the thing that struck me was how easy it is for us to think about. We go to the grocery store, the farmer's market, we come home, we turn the tap on, and we wash the fruits and vegetables, right? You know where I'm going with this? There's no running water. So you have to get the fruits and vegetables, come home, get water, boil the water, cool the water, then wash the fruits and vegetables. So the work behind it is so much more intense than we think, unless we are conscious about what this means, but yet how important it is to be able to have healthy kids so that you can go and do the work that you want to do. Literacy courses are also part of the non-financial services of microfinance. And, you know, I'm looking at this woman, and she's just paid her loan, and there are her children. And look at the way that she's looking at her daughter and her daughter's looking at her. My mom is the reason that I'm able to go to school. My mom has her own business. Maybe I can too. And I look at that, her little son looking at her as he's holding his crayons. My mom did that. A woman did that. My sister can do that. That's upending the status quo. So, question, why are 80% of the world's micro-borrowers women? Why do these microfinance organizations say we want women to be those? Well, here is Khadija. She is a she lives in Amman, Jordan. She's a Palestinian refugee. She went there when she was just a child, thinking she'd be going back. But she and many Palestinians ended up creating whole communities where there were just some cinder blocks before. And she has created this business of her own, and she takes care of her entire family, her extended family. A brother married with two children, and another brother who's married, and she is taking care of the entire family. Why are they women? Because this is what even Muhammad Yunus will say. Of course they're women. Women are the ones who open and enhance businesses. They're not going to spend their loan money in one day, like a man might. Now, I know there are men in this room who, you're laughing. Is that because... Doesn't surprise you?
No, not really.
Well, it doesn't surprise microfinance practitioners either, which is why 80% of the borrowers, micro-borrowers, are women. Women open and enhance businesses, like Juana in the foreground here. She is 80 years old. She started a business 13 years ago because she wanted to be able to take care of her daughter, Teresa, who's in the background. Teresa has some mental handicaps, and she will not be able to take care of herself or would not have been able to. Well, Juana started with a little table outside of her house, and she was selling sundries. And she got a loan, and she sold the sundries and made some money. And so she went back to Phnom, and she said, in Chile, and she said, I'd like to take out a bigger loan, and a bigger loan, and a bigger loan. And you can see that she's built out the front of her house, and she now sells all these things. Not only that, but she has trained her daughter to be the store manager. And so when Juana is unable to work, her daughter will now be able to take care of herself. So you can see that there's a support of the families that extends downward, and, you know, even when people are adults and have all these issues that need taking care of, and microfinance allows that to happen. The final thing that's really important about women, research has found, is that women save for important events. The important events may be there's an emergency. There may be someone who graduates from school. There may be a wedding. And there's their money to take care of those things. I want to tell you about different types of borrowing. Pentima, in that earlier picture, had a house that she could not use as collateral. Well, in microfinance, you don't need to have collateral. The women serve as each other's guarantors. They get together in groups of five, and each woman guarantees that if one woman is unable to pay any given week, that the others in the group will divvy up what she owes, including the interest, and they will take care of her that week. These groups are called solidarity groups, for instance. These women are in a group, and each woman has been elected to a role. One is the president, one is the secretary, one is the treasurer. This is upending the status quo. These women now have control in their group. They're looked up to. And these women are collecting the loans from the rest of their group members, and they're taking a look at what everyone owes and make sure that everyone is paying back on time and in full. Some organizations just start out with individual loans, and others, women have to graduate out of being a group borrower to being an individual borrower, like you see here, Jaida in the center of the picture. So Jaida is from Bangladesh. She started out as a group borrower, and she built this store from a little hovel that she and her family lived in, which I saw in the back of the store as I was passing it, which now just has little cooking pots in it. That's where she used to live. And now she welcomed me into her house and showed me her house. And this is her storefront. And she now sells all these foods in her village. But she also was invited, because she was such a good borrower, to take out a $180 loan to get a telephone and a subscription to become a village phone lady. So what's a village phone lady? She has a telephone, and not everybody does. This gentleman has just come up, and he said, I need to call my family in another village. So he borrows her phone, and he pays her for the time that he uses. And the number of people who use the phone, minus the $180, is her profit every single month. So she's now got two businesses. And in fact, her husband has taken on a business. He has cows in the back, and not only do they feed they use the milk for the three children, but they sell liters of milk every day. So I had an opportunity to go to China, and I met a woman named Heng Bian, who you'll see in a moment, and this is the kind of house that she used to live in. She used to also wash her clothes in this very polluted, freezing river. This is Heng Bian, and what she's doing is she is checking in one of her 1,700 bushels of packages of dirt. It's encased in plastic, and she's checking for signs of growth of mushrooms. She was as poor as every other woman who I've spoken about tonight, and she took a chance to start this business so that she could change her life and those of her two children. Sorry. This is Heng Bian's house today. She invited me in. She said, where would you like to sit? And there was a great big cushy couch and a big cushy chair. She turned on the lights. She turned on the fan. Her whole life had changed so much. I sat down. She gave me a little cup of tea. And I said, oh, you and your husband must like watching television, pointing at the television on the shelf. And she said, you know, we do like watching television, but we really prefer the color TV that's in our bedroom. Then the phone rang, and she went over, and someone who wants to buy her mushrooms, they come straight to her and other women in the village who've chosen to become these mushroom growers. She also uses the phone to call her son, who she is now able to put through college with her profits. Her husband has taken on a role. He helps her harvest the mushrooms, and he, when he's not busy, on his motorcycle that she bought him as a gift with the profits. I said, so Heng Bian, is there anything else you'd like to get? You've got a refrigerator, TV, your children are in school, anything else that you'd like? And she said, you know, I really want to buy a dryer so that I don't have to string my clothes against my beautiful new patio. I set out to focus primarily on women, almost exclusively on women, and then I met some amazing men. And since 20% of the micro borrowers in the world are men, I wanted to include a few of them in my book. And one of them is Leonardo Arce, who's here, Leo. And he makes Peach Pit toys. Take a look at the on the right-hand side. He went to the Peach the peach factory down the road, and he said, could I buy some peach pits from you? And they said, oh, they're in the dumpster, just take them. So he took them back to his house. He had one sander that he'd inherited from his father. He had to leave school when he was 8 so he could help his father build houses. So he has some capacity for building things, constructing things. And he makes these peach pit toys, sells them for between $2 and $6. Well, when he got an opportunity to take out a loan, he was able to buy more machinery. And with more machinery, he was able to start making things like this lampshade that he now has a jigsaw. So he's cutting lampshades. And in the back, he had stacked some wood. And I said, what are you going to build? He said, I'm going to start building furniture, and next week I'm hiring someone. So not everyone's made to be an entrepreneur, but entrepreneurs, given this opportunity, have an opportunity to hire other people. So it really expands out beyond the family. He invited me to go to the other side of his house. That was the workshop we were in the back. And he said, I just want to show you, I built this chimney so we now have heat with the profits that I've made. And I said, oh, those walls are so nice and smooth. He said, yes, I finally had enough money that I could cover over the cinder blocks so we're not too cold nor too hot at different times of the year. And our two children are now in private school. The other thing that made me really appreciate him was that his wife had a dream. Her dream was to become a nurse, but they had no money to go to send her. With his initial profits, he sent her back to nursing school. And so now with the combined profits, their children have a chance for as much education as they want. So here are the things that I learned from the women who know these and use these seven elements for success. Having a passion and a vision is really important in business and in life for all of us. And when we have that passion, we've sought after that passion. What is that for me? What is it that I want to do? To then have the courage to step forward into that, even when it's hard, and to stick with it. These women are proving that every single day when they're getting up again and again and hoping to sell their things so they can pay back their money and their interest and also savings. To be learners, these women are going every week or every other week, depending upon the microfinance organization, and they're learning. It may be literacy. It may be about health. It may be about how do you network more effectively. To be ongoing learners in life. The importance of connection, that we are social animals. We're meant to be together, to connect, and it's not a bad thing to say, I need help. I need to learn. How can you help me, or can I help you? Self-care, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. How are you taking care of yourself on a regular basis so that you can, in fact, sing with joy? To have conscious attitudes, persistence, patience being two of those. Both of those are really, really important if you want to be successful in business and if you want to be successful in life. And finally, to share your gift, share it to the world, be a mentor, help other people, share your book and what you've learned on a 3.5-year journey to meet women who are so inspirational, so empowering, such incredible role models for you may not think you have anything, and you're given a chance, and you take it, and you go for it. And you can change your life, you can change your family's life, you can change a community and a world. Thank you all for coming.
Our thanks to Dana Whitaker, author of Transforming Lives, $40 at a Time, Women and Microfinance, Upending the Status Quo. I am Alice McKeon, and I shall be moderating today's audience question period. So I'll get the other microphone, and let's begin.
You mentioned opportunities for education in the United States. How often did you see education coupled with the financial opportunities in the microfinance institutions that you visited abroad?
What kind of education are you? Are you any kind of education?
Education on business, creating business plans or anything like that?
Every single time I went to a microfinance meeting around the world, there is learning going on. Always, it's always coupled with the loan payback or receiving a new loan. Yeah. And I'll just add one thing. Some microfinance organizations have integrated that into their own organization, and other organizations get adjunct people to come in and teach everything, you know, everything about HIV/AIDS prevention or family planning or literacy training. So it just depends on the microfinance organization.
Dana, I'd like to commend your work. Great presentation.
Thank you.
And certainly the powers of microfinance came through. One question I have for you is, with regard to the women versus men in the microfinance world, that was the only part of the presentation that sort of shocked me, because in a sense that it's sort of stipulating that one sex is, you know, more likely to be fit for, more qualified to receive a loan. And do we want to be careful about saying that one sex is more likely to have certain qualities, and isn't that the type of thinking that led to the female oppression to begin with? And do we want to make it equal access for everyone? And really, that microfinance is a great thing, but not that, you know, it's better for one sex than the other.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues with microfinance practitioners, beginning with Muhammad Yunus, who really, you know, that is his call to action, is changing the status of women. And when women have access to finances versus having it come through the male part of the family first, is something that is very, very important to microfinance practitioners, to change the status quo. So there's more sense of, there's no more capacity for equality rather than, may I do this? One woman I met, let me give you an example to see if this helps at all. When I was in Ghana, I met a group of women, and one in particular came up to me, and we were in a building that had corrugated tin roof, and she came up to me and she said, I sold this tin roof. I sell this tin roofing. And I said, wow, that's great. And she said, you know, I no longer have to ask my husband permission to do things. I have pride. Now, would that have happened if her husband had received the loan to start the business, whatever that business would have been? I don't. I don't know her husband. But that is an example of changing the status quo, where women have capacity to make decisions, to change their status internally and externally, to be able to make decisions in their families and in communities, and as you saw in the group lending process, where they're the ones who are, people need to be accountable to, and they need to be accountable back as president, secretary, treasurer. But to have a confrontation about women are better than men, the studies have shown that is what women are doing with the money that they are getting and with the profits that they're making, more so than men.
Hi, I have a complimentary question. In so many of these cultures, women are in fact disenfranchised, and in fact the microfinancing is designed to elevate them as participants. And I wondered, what kind of stories did you hear about husbands or male family members who were opposed to women either getting financing and developing themselves as people through microfinancing? Did you hear stories about that?
It's funny. The first microfinance conference that I went to, that was my question. Here's the response that I received. There was a study done by Opportunity International, and that's the organization that supports Stella Sabang, the cover of the book. And what they found is that when women are given financing and they become the micro borrowers instead of the men, there is an initial spike in abuse. When profits start coming in and the family starts changing its capacity to eat and have better housing and clothing, et cetera, then that diminishes. In some cultures, it's very important to go in and speak to the elders of a community before just going in and saying, you know, we just want the women in this community to come to this meeting. And you go to the elders and you ask, in many cultures, it's men, right? And to talk to them about how it could change the families, how it could change the community, and up the finances of everybody. So there's a protocol that is really, really important to abide by. Yeah. And it doesn't always work. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. You're listening to Transforming Lives, $40 at a Time, Women in Microfinance, Upending the Status Quo with Dana Whitaker. We have 2 minutes remaining. And one last question.
So if you're interested in supporting microfinance programs or projects, mm-hmm. How do you go about finding a good one?
There are about 10,000 microfinance organizations, and so that seems daunting. And so there are some different options. Domestically, there are some in the Bay Area that I'd be more than happy to talk to you about. We've talked about a few, and you know about them. Women's Initiative for Self-Employment, CEO Women, Renaissance Women are local, for instance. In the back of my book, there is a section called Comprehensive Resources, and those comprehensive resources include Mix Market, M-I-X. And the mixed market, you can go by country, and you can look and see to whom they loan, how many people they loan to, what the percentage of payback is. So you can do your own due diligence. There's also in the back of the book not only that those comprehensive resources, but different organizations, all those in bold are those that I visited, whose clients I visited around the world. So that's a start for you. But and then Grameen Foundation, which I mentioned also earlier in the program, they do the due diligence for organizations themselves, and there are many organizations that are like that. You go not many, but there are some that you go straight to those and you say, you know, I want to read who you are supporting, and if you like where they are and what they're doing, then you can go that way. So lots of options. Yeah.
Okay. Our thanks to Dana Whitaker, author of Transforming Lives, $40 at a Time, Women and Microfinance, Upending the Status Quo. We thank our audience here as well as those listening on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion where you are in the know, is adjourned.
Someone else had a question?
You know, if you want to answer some more questions, Dana, certainly feel free if you
sure.
would like to.
I have a question about leadership. So once the women start to take on other leadership roles in their society?
Often. Mm-hmm. Right. There is, that all of a sudden the community expands beyond just men, or even maybe there weren't things going on that then get created because of these groups of women. Yep. Yeah. I don't have access to that answer, but right here. But do women become political? I can't imagine that they don't. Right, especially in these small villages. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I have two questions for you. One, can you speak a little bit to
Okay. The publishing process. Are any of you authors, published authors? Congratulations. Yeah. Some people go get an agent. Some people go straight to the a publishing house. Some people try both those and they don't work, and then they self-publish. Some people decide to self-publish out of the gate. I was the second. I was the first one. I went, tried to get an agent, tried to go straight to publishing houses. People said, love your book, love your photographs, but it's a niche market. What's microfinance? I'm going, yeah, that's why I'm writing the book. So we don't want to take a chance on it. So I ended up self-publishing, found one self-publishing house that had ever done color photographs before. And so it was the last thing in the world I wanted to do. I wanted to get the book done by somebody else. I wanted them to do the marketing. I wanted them to do it. Ended up being the best thing in the world that could have happened to me. I got to pick the photographs, which one was going to be on the cover. I got to pick the font. I got to pick which order the stories were in. The feel of it is all it was from me, but there was a guy who really got me at this at the press that I used and what I wanted, and he did it. Love Jonathan. I don't know what I'd do without him. Yeah. So there are different avenues to take. Yeah. And what's next for me? Well, what is now for me is I felt so transformed myself. Both internally and externally. I was a high school teacher for 17 years, teaching in the inner city, and loved doing that. And then I realized I needed to do this book. And then that was such a huge change. And doing book talks and those sorts of things, which I had never obviously done before, that I thought, I've really changed a lot, and I am growing. It's been really scary and really rewarding, and I decided that I wanted to become a coach. So I went back to school so that I could help my primary audience, my niche audience or group of clients are women now today who want to make personal and professional transitions in their lives and want to figure out how to do it and what is it that I really care about, what do I want to do, how can I work better where I am. So I'm helping women do that. Yeah, so that's that, and that's growing, and I love doing that. So, and I continue to do book talks to businesses and organizations, women's groups, groups like this, to teach people about microfinance, and it just may be something that they'll say, gosh, I'm really looking for purpose in my life. I'm not sure what it is. Maybe microfinance is one of those things that I'd like to hang my some of my expertise or other resources on. Yeah. So that really keeps me going. Love it. Yeah.
And if you don't have the expertise in business, I was also in education for 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Expertise, when you are, I was talking to you about Connect events with Women's Initiative, for instance, expertise is being a good listener and asking a question that might make a difference to somebody that they hadn't thought of. That's the expertise that is enough. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And in these Connect events that I was telling you about, the mentoring that Women's Initiative provides about four times a year, and all of you would be invited to be such a mentor. Oftentimes, you might be with a group of entrepreneurs and other people who are teachers or MBAs or whatever we are, and it's a conversation. So it's not like they're asking us a question, we have to say the answer. It's providing that opportunity for people to share their own expertise. So you don't have to know the answers to everything. It can be a group discussion that generates a new thought. I never thought of it that way. Yeah. So don't be intimidated by any means. Yeah. And I must say that I've been to quite a few in the last 5 years, 6 years, and I always, 100% of the time, have come away thinking, I can't believe how much I got out of that, how invaluable that was for me, how rich that was for me to be able to talk with these women and what I learned, too. So, yeah, it's a true partnership. Yeah. Any other questions? Yep. Oh yeah, there is that is so crucial because you get a loan, but you're not sure how much you're paying over time, over 52 weeks, for instance, and consultative group to assist the poor, CGAP, that's also in the comprehensive resources part of the book. They are zeroing in on that very issue, and they're doing research and sending people out who are not in that microfinance organization, anyone, and they are going out and they are finding out what are people charging, and it's as you can imagine, a microfinance organization, it's only going to help them to be able to say, this is what we're charging, because who's going to want to lend to them then, right? Who's going to want to donate to them? What businesses are going to want to say, we want to put our money there? Foundations are not going to want to put their money in that microfinance organization if they can't tell us what is the interest rate that we're charging, right? And tell the clients too. So yeah, CGAP, yeah, online, great organization. Oh yeah, they are regulated, but it doesn't mean that they're saying how much they're being totally straightforward with what their interest rates are, and how they compound, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Right. Regulations in many countries are focused on whether you. A microfinance organization can take deposits or not. Yeah. And very, very few NGOs, non-governmental organizations, can take deposits. It's you have to become a regulated bank in a way. Yeah. Sure. Be happy to. Thank you all for coming.